We've already covered slide 9, but let's start today by reviewing what's happening here to segue into the rest of it. Transcription has already ended, and that produced the so-called pre-mRNA, which gets its name because it's not yet ready for translation, right? In other words, pre-mRNA is RNA that is produced by transcription, but that needs to undergo post-transcriptional modification. And there are two major types of post-transcriptional modification, or two major ways in which mRNA gets post-transcriptionally modified. One of which has already happened to this top piece, but it's still pre-mRNA because the modification is not complete yet. And what has already been done, as you see, is the five prime cap and the poly A tail have been inserted, the yellow regions. The rest of modification, though, involves removing the introns from the pre-mRNA transcript. The introns are not going to be used as codons. They're not going to be part of the final version of mRNA. So they need to be removed, and the exons need to be sewn together end to end to form the shorter, without the intron, mature version of mRNA, or simply the mRNA. Once you have the mature mRNA, then you're ready for translation. But all of that stuff that happens to the pre-mRNA before translation is post-transcriptional modification. Let's look at the job of removing these introns. Slide 10. Removing the introns and hooking together the exons is called splicing, mRNA splicing, by analogy with film splicing. You know, if you have a damaged film, one or two frames is damaged, you cut them out and then hook together the other frames end to end, just like introns get cut out or excised. Doing that, in other words, removing the introns from a pre-mRNA transcript, involves a pretty complex molecular machine, which is called a spliceosome. A spliceosome contains 100 or more, maybe, depends, 100 or more molecules, many of which are proteins, but not all of which are proteins. So this one spliceosome that you see here includes multiple SNRNPs, as they're called. An SNRNP is a small nuclear ribonucleoprotein. That's what SNRNP stands for, in other words, which is sometimes pronounced SNRP. But a ribonucleoprotein is called that because it's part nucleic acid and part protein, all right? An SNRNP is just part of a spliceosome, but even an SNRNP by itself is already a complex of molecules because it's partly RNA and partly protein. Speaking of RNA, we've already talked about one type of important RNA in this process, which is messenger RNA, right? That's what the transcript's made out of. But that is just one of many types of RNA. We're not going to even mention all of the types of RNA in this course. But snRNA is another type of RNA. And that's what the specific kind of RNA in a SNRP is. It's snRNA plus protein to make an snRNP. Well, there are several of those snRNPs, along with a whole bunch of other proteins, making up the overall molecular machine called the spliceosome. And the job of the spliceosome is to recognize where each intron begins and ends, so that those beginning and ending parts can be cut. When an intron's ends get cut, that allows for the intron itself to be released, Now, as far as the process of gene expression is concerned, this is trash, right? The intron isn't going to be used for as codons. It's not going to lead to translation. But it's still valuable material. It's made out of RNA nucleotides. So the cutout introns will get digested by the cell into individual RNA nucleotides and part of the overall RNA nucleotide pool in the cell that can be used to make any other kind of RNA that the cell needs at the moment. It might be part of another mRNA molecule or part of any other kind of RNA. So it gets recycled. But what's left, the part that's going to be part of the final or mature version of mRNA, are the exons. And so the spliceosome isn't responsible for just cutting out the introns. If it did that, then you'd have a bunch of pieces, which wouldn't work, right? The introns need to be removed, and the exons that were on either side of the intron need to be hooked together so that the mature mRNA is one continuous RNA strand. The SNRPs are important in here because the RNA component of each SNRP, or SNRNP, is what actually recognizes the sequences that are at the beginnings and ends of introns. That should make sense to you because RNA nucleotides can be complementary to other RNA nucleotides, right? That's what these little dots indicate. This part of the snRNA is recognizing this part of the mRNA that's the beginning of the intron. That's how it knows where to cut it. All right, so that is mRNA splicing. Let's go to slide 11 and look at what exons, which are the parts that remain in the mature mRNA, the parts that get expressed, in other words, what they correspond to in the final product. The final product is a polypeptide. Right? That's the goal of this whole overall gene expression process, including transcription and translation. The goal is to make a polypeptide. You see a polypeptide being made here indirectly from the information that was originally in a gene at the top. It's a simple gene with three exons and two introns. Now, really, you shouldn't, strictly speaking, exons and introns are words that should be applied to mRNA, not DNA. But the mRNA wouldn't exist without the DNA coding for it, right, in the gene. So for any mRNA, the sequence of nucleotides in an mRNA correspond to a sequence in the gene originally. Therefore, even though exons and introns really are words that describe the mRNA, there are corresponding parts in the DNA of the gene, and we therefore use the word exon and intron to refer to those regions in the DNA sometimes as well. But importantly, introns, if you use intron to describe the gene, those don't ever get cut out, right? The DNA stays. Real introns, meaning the introns that are in mRNA, are the ones that get removed. The RNA gets edited, not the DNA. Okay, well, anyway, the color coding here shows you that each exon here, not only the gene, but each exon in the messenger RNA that isn't shown here, corresponds to just a part of the overall polypeptide that gets produced. And that part is called a domain. You see three domains here corresponding to the three exons. A domain is not a molecule. It's not a complete molecule. It's part of a polypeptide. So in that sense, a domain is very similar to a functional group that we've studied before, right? Except that functional groups aren't nearly as big a collection of atoms. But a functional group, like a hydroxyl or a carbonyl, any of the ones we studied, that particular collection of atoms that make up a functional group is called a functional group because a larger molecule that includes that functional group has a certain function by including that particular functional group. That's why they're called functional groups, right? Similarly, a domain gives the overall polypeptide that has such a domain a particular function because of the particular shape that that domain has. We've already talked a lot of times about the fact that shape is everything when it comes to the function of a protein, right? Proteins function in various ways, but any given protein functions the way it does because of its particular shape. So a domain is just part of the shape of a polypeptide, and that part, that domain, is specified by one of the exons in the mRNA. Now, something that's not shown here, but that happens, is called alternative mRNA splicing. I've already told you what splicing is. That's the removal of introns, right? And the sewing together of the exons. Well, if that's the only thing that ever happened, in other words, if all the exons were included every time and all the introns removed, then every time you transcribe the gene and make that particular mRNA, you would splice it to create exactly the same kind of mature mRNA, and therefore, if that goes into translation, you would end up making exactly the same kind of polypeptide every time. Right? Does that make sense? But that's not actually what has to happen, because there is alternative mRNA splicing that's possible. So the gene is always the same. It gets transcribed the same way, so you end up making the same pre-mRNA from that gene each time. But under different conditions in the cell, it can be the mRNA that's produced, the pre-mRNA, can be spliced differently depending on the conditions. And we're not going to get into how the cell controls this, but it can do it. What it boils down to really is that under some conditions, some but not all of the exons will be included in the mature mRNA. In other words, some exons can be treated as introns and cut out under one condition, and in another set of conditions, another set of exons from that same kind of pre-mRNA would be the ones that were included in the final product. Well, you see what that leads to, right? If you splice the same kind of mRNA differently under different conditions, that means the final product is going to be different. The final polypeptide that gets built will be a different collection of domains if you use different exons in the final mRNA. You following me on that? And what that means in turn is that a single gene can actually code for multiple different polypeptides depending on how the mRNA is spliced after it's transcribed. Well, this greatly increases the efficiency of the genome. What I mean by that is you don't need as many genes as there are proteins that you have to build. And this is yet another reason why the so-called one gene, one polypeptide hypothesis is not right. Because a single gene can actually code for multiple polypeptides depending on how the alternative genes, alternative mRNA splicing occurs. Now, just to use one example, there are things that are called isozymes, which are enzymes and therefore proteins, right? Polypeptides. But isozymes, just like isotopes, you know, there are various kinds of magnesium, for instance, which are called isotopes of each other. They have something in common. They're magnesium. Well, isozymes are families, or an isozyme family is different versions of an enzyme, but all with the same function. So in that sense, they're the same kind of enzyme, but they're not exactly the same protein. They have slightly different sequences of amino acids, but they work the same way. Why would you do this? Because it's possible that each of the different versions works best at slightly different conditions compared to the other versions. Like temperature, for instance. You would want to build the particular isozyme version that actually works best for the conditions that are present in the cell, right? Well, you could accomplish that by having a different gene coding for each of the different versions, right? A complete gene for each individual version of isozyme. That would be perfectly possible. But each isozyme is very similar to the others, so they have a lot of domains in common that they just differ in one or two other domains. So if you did have a separate gene for each of these different versions, there would be a lot of repetition from one gene to the next because of those regions that they share. Does that make sense? By using alternative mRNA splicing, you can have one gene with all the versions actually packed into it as exons, and then depending on conditions, you either include some exons or don't include them to make the different versions. And specifically, you make the version that works best under the conditions the cell is experiencing. And this is one of the reasons why we were so surprised when we got the results of the Human Genome Project at how few genes humans have. We thought it was going to be a much higher number. Well, part of the reason that it's lower is because of alternative mRNA splicing, efficient use of genes. All right, that's not shown in 11, but I wanted to mention it while we were talking about exons. Let's go on to 12 then, which is the rest of the gene expression process. What we've been talking about up to now, today, is the stuff that happens between transcription and translation. In other words, after transcription has ended, the modification of that mRNA and the splicing, that's post-transcriptional, but it's not. It occurs before translation. Translation can't occur until you have the final version of the mRNA, the mature mRNA, in other words. And then that leads to the second major part of gene expression, which is translation. Well, we can see translation occurring in slide 12. And what is the big event? What is the intent of translation? Right, in translation, that's when you finally have a polypeptide get built. Up until that point, you're just manipulating codes for how to build, eventually, a polypeptide. But none of that stuff up to this point has involved any amino acid, which is what polypeptides are made out of, right? Now it's time to actually assemble the polypeptide that all of the previous stuff codes for, using one amino acid at a time hooked to the previous one. In other words, assemble a polymer out of monomers. But specifically, the polymer is a polypeptide, and specifically, the monomers are amino acids. Doing that requires not only the code, which is the RNA, the mRNA shown in red in this cartoon, but also another molecular machine capable of reading that code and actually assembling the polypeptide. That is a ribosome, the brown thing. A ribosome, we've already talked about, starting in the tour of the cells chapter. It's a two-part molecular machine because there are two ribosomal subunits, small subunit and large subunit. And remember, Back in that chapter, I told you that the picture you were looking at first, when we first looked at a ribosome, was a lie, because it showed a small and large subunit together without anything else present. That doesn't happen. Instead, in a cell, you have many, many identical copies of small subunits, which are all interchangeable. Many, many copies of large ribosomal subunits, interchangeable. So it doesn't matter which one you use as the small and which one you use as a large, they all fit together. But they're not interacting with each other. They're just individual subunits until a messenger RNA comes along and binds to a small subunit. That happens first, as we'll see later, and then the large subunit comes along. That's already happened, though, so we're looking at this a little later in the process. Anyway, the ribosome itself is the molecular machine responsible for for reading the code in messenger RNA and for assembling the polypeptide. We've already talked about two kinds of RNA, right? mRNA and small nuclear RNA, snRNA. That was part of the SNRP earlier. There's still other kinds of RNA we haven't talked about and will. And there's plenty of other kinds of RNA that we're just not going to talk about in this course. But the ribosome itself, and you don't see the detail here, you just see brownness. But molecularly speaking, the subunits of a ribosome are mixtures of RNA and protein. And the kind of RNA that makes up ribosomes is called ribosomal RNA, or rRNA. This brings up something else, actually. You should expect the process of building a polypeptide to involve enzymes, right? To involve catalysts. We're used to the idea that just about anything that happens chemically in a cell requires a catalyst, right? And almost always, that catalyst is an enzyme. And always, up to this point in this course, the catalyst has been an enzyme. Well, there was a long time in biological history when we thought that all biological catalysts were proteins. And that's what we named enzymes. It is true that every enzyme is a protein. And every enzyme, by definition, is a catalyst. So all enzymes are proteins acting as catalysts. But what we got wrong is that it doesn't actually have to be a protein for it to act as a catalyst in a cell. The vast majority of biological catalysts are proteins, and those are called the enzymes. But then we discovered that certain kinds of RNA can actually have catalytic activity as well, act as catalysts. And we didn't want to call those enzymes because that word was reserved for proteins. So we made up the word ribozyme. Which is an enzyme, an RNA acting as a catalyst. A ribozyme is not an enzyme, but it does the same job, basically, as an enzyme. Just as RNA instead of as protein. And the reason we use that word is because the RNA that's part of a ribosome has catalytic activity. Ribo as in ribonucleic acid, right? It's RNA. Okay. So that's still another kind of RNA, but there's yet another important RNA type that's involved in translation, and that's symbolized in the cartoon as these teal-colored bent rods, each of which is a transfer RNA, or tRNA. Now, transfer RNA gets its name because of its job of bringing in or transferring amino acids to the growing chain one at a time. Any given tRNA molecule at any given moment is in one of two major conditions or forms. It's either uncharged or it's charged. And that doesn't have anything to do with electrical charge. An uncharged tRNA is simply a tRNA molecule that is not carrying an amino acid. It's not hooked to anything. These two on the left edge are uncharged tRNAs because there is no purple amino acid connected to them. They're not carrying anything. That's one major possibility. The other major possibility, of course, is that a tRNA is carrying something. So we call that tRNA, that kind of tRNA, or a tRNA in that condition, I should say, a charged tRNA. The reason I say in that condition is because an uncharged tRNA is not going to stay uncharged. It's worthless if it's uncharged. Uncharged tRNAs become charged by having amino acids hooked onto them. And then they'll become uncharged again when they deliver those amino acids. So any given tRNA is going to be in part of the time they're going to be uncharged, part of the time they're going to be charged. But even though charged is the second major form of a tRNA, there's two ways for a tRNA to be charged. Charged itself simply means the tRNA is connected to at least one amino acid. One of those possibilities of being charged is that the tRNA is hooked to exactly one amino acid. And the one coming into the ribosome here at the right edge, where the red arrow is showing it coming in, this is an example of a tRNA that's carrying exactly one amino acid. These two are as well, right? If a tRNA is charged with just one amino acid, then we specifically call it an aminoacyl tRNA. So the one that's coming in to the ribosome is an aminoacyl tRNA, and it's specifically carrying glycine, but any given aminoacyl tRNA is carrying just one amino acid, whatever the amino acid is. It's also possible, though, for a tRNA to be carrying multiple amino acids, not just one. Although, even in that case, the tRNA is directly connected to just one of those amino acids, like in the middle here. Right? This one is carrying multiple amino acids, but it's directly connected to this one, which is then connected to the rest of them as a strand. In other words, this is a charged tRNA that's not carrying an amino acid, but instead carrying a peptide. A peptide is some length of amino acids hooked together, so either two or more. That's why we use words like bipeptide, tripeptide, oligopeptide, eventually polypeptide. Two or more, though, makes it a peptide of some size. And if a tRNA is carrying a peptide instead of just a single amino acid, then we don't call it an aminoacyl tRNA, we call it a peptidyl tRNA. And that's what the one in the middle slot here of this ribosome is at the moment. It's a peptidyl tRNA. Now, think about what's trying to be accomplished here in this translation process. You're trying to build not just a polypeptide, but a very specific polypeptide, right? We talked about the genetic code and the fact that it cannot be ambiguous, right? It is not ambiguous, meaning when a codon is read by a ribosome, the cell better be sure to put exactly the correct amino acid that that codon corresponds to onto the growing polypeptide strand. Otherwise, you'll end up making the wrong polypeptide, right? So, translation makes the polypeptide, but it needs to ensure it makes the correct polypeptide, and that requires maintaining the integrity of the information that's in the code. Well, that's what tRNA molecules allow for. They make sure that the amino acid that's brought in next to add to the growing polypeptide is the correct amino acid that corresponds to the codon being read by the ribosome. The ribosome reads a codon one at a time as it goes along the length of the mRNA. The mRNA is broken into codons, right? But this is kind of like a strip of film. The mRNA is kind of like a strip of film being fed through a projector, one frame at a time. Well, here the frames are codons. So this part where this tRNA is coming in, this is the currently read codon. And in order to make the correct polypeptide, you need to make sure that whatever amino acid corresponds to GGC in the genetic code is the only one allowed to come in being brought by a tRNA. Well, that is ensured because of something we're going to talk about on the tRNA in a second. But if you look that up in the genetic code, it's glycine specifically. That's the amino acid that this codon specifies. So only the type of RNA or tRNA that's allowed to carry glycine can come into this slot. That's what maintains the integrity of the information. And that's what will ensure that the correct polypeptide version will be made in translation. Let's look at a tRNA then in slide 13. First of all, importantly, there is not just one kind of tRNA. There are many kinds of tRNA because there are many kinds of amino acids, right? And even more codons. Because of redundancy, there's even more codons than there are amino acids that they specify. You remember that? But since there are many codons, each of which is specific, there need to be multiple different kinds of tRNA, not just a bunch of copies of the same tRNA. There are different categories of tRNA. And this will become more clear in a minute. But first of all, tRNA is an RNA, of course. And you should be used to the fact that RNA is usually a single strand, as opposed to DNA, which is usually a double strand. This isn't the shape of tRNA at the top. It has more of a shape like this on the bottom. But if you force it, flatten it out onto one plane, like at the top, then you can see that it has what is called a clover leaf arrangement with three hairpin loops, like the three leaflets of a clover. It's all one strand, though, even though it doubles back on itself in certain places, so it kind of looks like it's two strands. It's all one strand with a 5' end and a 3' end. It just folds back on itself, and those parts that fold back just happen to be complementary to each other, even though they're part of the same strand, and that's why that's what forms this cloverleaf arrangement. Since it's an RNA, of course, the entire strand is just some sequence of A's, U's, T's, and I mean A, U's, C's, and G's, right? So we can see nucleotides all the way through the sequence. But this middle hairpin of the three features an especially important three-letter sequence of nucleotides, which collectively, that whole triplet, all three of them, is called an anticodon. Now, anti here refers to complementarity. What is a codon? Sequence of what? No, it's not part of an enzyme. Who wants to say what a codon is?
Sequence of three nucleotides.
Where? No, not in the ribosome. Right, in what RNA? Right. A codon is a three nucleotide sequence in messenger RNA. It's one word, in a sense, that in the genetic code specifies one amino acid. That's what the codon is. It's part of mRNA. The anticodon is part of a tRNA molecule. But it's called an anticodon because that specific sequence happens to be perfectly complementary to one of the codons that are possible. There's 64 possible codons, right, in the genetic code, because it's 4 times 4 times 4. But there's only 61 of those 64 that specify amino acids because there's three stop codons. So there's 61 possible amino acid specifying codons. Each one is its own sequence. But by complementarity rules, you can figure out what the complementary sequence is for any given codon, right? That's what an anticodon is. A triplet in tRNA that is complementary to a triplet in mRNA, the codon itself. Well, back to this notion that there are different categories of tRNA. The reason there are different categories of tRNA is that each category has its own anticodon corresponding to a specific codon in mRNA. There's many, many copies of each kind, each category of tRNA, but the cell needs all of the different categories because each individual category of tRNA is allowed to carry, if it's carrying anything, if it's charged, in other words, it's allowed to carry only one type of amino acid. That's the only kind that's ever going to be able to carry that particular tRNA molecule. And this is where the integrity of the information is maintained, because the particular amino acid that this one tRNA type is allowed to carry is the amino acid that is specified by a codon in the genetic code that is complementary to this tRNA's anticodon. To clarify this last statement, let's temporarily go back to 12. GGC happens to be the currently read codon. This is the next codon that comes up. Right? This is the one that's being read. If you look up GGC in the genetic code, it specifies glycine as the amino acid. What is complementary to GGC?
CCG,
which is why any tRNA that has CCG as its anticodon is only ever allowed to carry glycine. That way, when it comes into the A slot, which it will only be allowed to do if it has perfect complementarity with the codon, other types of tRNA with a different anticodon aren't going to be allowed in right now because they're not complementary to this codon. But if it is complementary, that will ensure that the correct amino acid gets brought in because this particular kind of tRNA with that particular anticodon corresponding to this particular codon is only ever allowed to carry this amino acid. Therefore, the correct amino acid gets delivered corresponding to the codon. Is that all clear?
At what point does the amino acid connect to the tRNA?
Well, we're getting to that, but okay. It's coming up in just next slide, pretty much. But up to this point, this aminoacyl tRNA was just part of a whole population of all the different kinds of aminoacyl tRNAs, each just waiting, basically, for its particular codon corresponding to its particular anticodon to come up. But each different kind of tRNA that's out here just as part of the cytosol, like these two, they're all carrying only their kind of amino acid that they're allowed to carry. And if it's not a codon that is complementary to that particular anticodon, then they won't be used until that codon comes up. They're just waiting for translation to call them. All right, now, back on 13, I haven't quite finished this slide. The job of a tRNA, of course, is to carry an amino acid. Right now, this one is uncharged, right? There's nothing attached to it, but it's going to be charged. Anyway, when a tRNA does become charged, when an amino acid gets hooked to it, in other words, it's specifically the 3' end of the tRNA molecule to which the amino acid gets attached. So that's why it's called the amino acid attachment site, 3' end. All right, now back to your question, how does this happen? That's the subject of slide 14. Imagine what you have here. In a cell, you have a bunch of tRNAs, many, many copies of each category of tRNA. Each category has a specific anticodon corresponding to a specific codon. But some of those tRNAs are uncharged, and therefore they cannot be used for translation until they get an amino acid attached to them. They're just part of the tRNA pool, though. They're not involved in translation yet. They need to prepare for that, they need to get charged. They need to be made into aminoacyl tRNAs, in other words. But not just haphazardly, because you can't attach just any amino acid. You have to make sure that only the amino acid that that particular kind of TNA is allowed to carry is attached. That is ensured by the action of a family of enzymes, one of which is shown here in kind of grayish color. This thing that kind of is shaped like a human embryo is an enzyme. And as you can see, its name is aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. Importantly, aminoacyl tRNA synthetase is not aminoacyl tRNA. A synthetase is an enzyme that brings things together. Syn means together. So aminoacyl tRNA synthetase brings together a tRNA and the amino acid that it's allowed to carry. And when that amino acid gets hooked to that tRNA, that turns the tRNA from uncharged tRNA into aminoacyl tRNA. That's why the enzyme is called that. Well, I said a little bit ago that This is a family of enzymes. So there is not just one master type of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. Just as there are different kinds of tRNA, each able to carry only its own kind of amino acid, there are also different versions of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase, each of which works on just one kind of tRNA. They all work the same way, but they all work specifically for one type of tRNA. So look at the pretty complicated active site of this synthetase. Part of that active site allows a perfect fit for just a specific kind of amino acid. In this particular example, it's adenosine. For this version of synthetase, it's always going to be only adenosine. A different amino acid will require a different kind of enzyme. Well, you need to bring that particular amino acid together with the type of tRNA that's allowed to carry adenosine, and similarly for the other tRNAs. That's what the rest of the active site is for. So this enzyme cannot allow just any tRNA in here. It needs to allow the tRNA whose anticodon is complementary to the codon that specifies as adenosine from the genetic code. And that's what this little flat part of the active site is for. This part of the enzyme recognizes a particular anticodon. And so only tRNA molecules with that particular anticodon get allowed in and therefore get attached to this particular amino acid. That ensures that the information is going to be correct and the correct kind of amino acid will be added to the polypeptide. The same exact thing is happening with all the other kinds of amino acids under the direction of the other versions of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. And so this is continuously happening just in the cytosol, so that at any given moment, there are many, many copies of each different kind of aminoacyl tRNA, but each one is carrying just that one amino acid that it's allowed to carry. And each aminoacyl tRNA is simply waiting until the ribosome reads a codon that corresponds to that tRNA's anticodon. That's when it's called into the ribosome, because that's the only time that there will be complementary match and that tRNA will be allowed to come into that slot. All the others will just keep waiting until their codon comes up. Okay. Well, let's look at that process. Slide 15. Let's look at the slots I've been talking about. The top part of 15 doesn't really give you much useful information. It kind of shows you the real shape. But the cartoon version in the middle is much easier to look at to see these three slots. There are three slots in a ribosome. And you likely read these as EPA because in English that's the direction we read in. But actually, right to left here is the order in which they get used. A, and then P, and then E. And these letters are initials that stand for a different thing for each slot. The A slot is short for aminoacyl tRNA binding site, meaning that what comes into that A slot is an aminoacyl tRNA, which itself means a tRNA that's carrying exactly one amino acid. That's what comes in. That's when tRNA is doing its job of delivering a new amino acid to the growing polypeptide. Comes into the A slot. The P slot is short for peptidyl tRNA binding site. And on the bottom figure, you can see that this one that's in the P slot, this tRNA that's in the P slot, is indeed a peptidyl tRNA. It's, at this moment, carrying four, a peptide made up of four amino acids. The E slot is short for exit, or eject. You could think of it that way as well, because when things shift, and I'll talk more about shifting in a minute, a tRNA that has transferred all of its amino acids that it's carrying to the next amino acid will now be an uncharged tRNA. So this one that's a peptidyl tRNA at the moment is carrying a peptide made of four amino acids, right? But it's going to transfer that four amino acid peptide to this one amino acid that the aminoacyl tRNA is carrying at the moment. So imagine that having already happened. When that happens, then this one that's in the P slot is no longer a peptidyl tRNA, right? That's going to be an uncharged tRNA since it's no longer carrying anything. And everything's going to shift one codon so that it will be put, that empty one, that uncharged tRNA, will be put into the E slot and then ejected. All right? Also, when it shifts, this one that's in the A slot right now and then is in this picture attached to just one amino acid is an aminoacyl tRNA for the moment, but when it receives these other four from the peptidyl tRNA, that's going to turn this tRNA into a peptidyl tRNA carrying five. You see that? And it will then shift over to the P slot, leaving this A slot empty to read the next codon in line in the messenger RNA, allowing for just a particular kind of tRNA to come in carrying a new amino acid. That's the essence of translation. And any questions on this slide? If not, then we will look at the particulars of translation, starting with slide 16. This is translation, of course, which is totally different from transcription that we've already covered, and that happens earlier. But what were the names of the three phases of transcription? Exactly. Initiation gets it started, elongation makes the RNA strand longer and longer in transcription, and then termination ends it. Well, it's totally different stuff happening in translation, but translation has three phases that have exactly the same three names. So translation features initiation, elongation, and termination as well. What we're looking at in 16 is initiation of translation. Here's where we can see why I called that picture of a complete ribosome by itself a lie. You don't have that, the two subunits come together right away. The first thing you have is one of the many, many identical copies of small subunits, ribosomal subunits, comes together with a messenger RNA molecule. That's the red thing. Those two connect to each other, specifically at a place on the small subunit called the mRNA binding site. Think of the pictures I've shown you before of the mRNA. There were so-called UTRs. Do you remember what that stands for? UTRs are untranslated regions. So the whole mRNA is a sequence of AUs, Cs, and Gs, right? It's a nucleic acid. But there's a certain sequence of A's, U's, C's, and G's until you get to the start codon. And those are not going to be translated. They're not going to correspond to any amino acids. but they're not worthless. They are there to help this thing dock to this small subunit. So this is an untranslated region right here. And part of that, it gets recognized by this mRNA binding site and allows the mRNA to bind to the small ribosomal subunit. When that happens, by the way, the start codon, which remember there's only one of, it's AUG in the genetic code, that start codon, which is the first one to be read, gets centered in perfect position at what will be, once the other subunit comes along, the P slot. So as a close-up here, you can see that this is AUG. That's the start codon. Well, there's only one sequence that is complementary to AUG. UAC, right? When you look up AUG, which is the start codon but does double duty, when you look that up in the genetic code, you see that the amino acid that it specifies is methionine, M-E-T. Well, AUG's complement is UAC. Therefore, only tRNA that has UAC as its anticodon is allowed to carry methionine. And one of those aminoacyl tRNAs with that anticodon and carrying a single methionine will come in and hydrogen bond to the start codon that's here. All of this happens before the large subunit is even present. That's part of initiation. By the way, though, this is why something I said in a different lecture is true. Since the start codon specifies methionine, and every translation begins with the start codon, that means every polypeptide that's built has methionine as the first amino acid. Even polypeptides that shouldn't have that methionine there. They have to temporarily have it because that's how it works. Ones that want that methionine there, it'll remain. But other polypeptides, after they are built by translation, need to get rid of that methionine later. That would be post-translational modification of the polypeptide. But they all start out with methionine as the first amino acid because AUG, the start codon, also specifies methionine. All right, now next, you have to spend some energy. That's what this GTP is here for. We are used to thinking of nucleoside triphosphates as carrying a bunch of energy, right? But usually in the form of ATP. ATP is a nucleoside triphosphate, remember, where the nucleoside in that case is adenosine. Specifically, adenosine is simply adenine and ribose hooked together. ATP is usually used for carrying energy because it's so versatile. But it's not always the required form of energy-carrying nucleoside triphosphate. GTP has a bunch of energy in it as well for the same reason. It's carrying three phosphates, but GTP is guanosine triphosphate. The nucleoside that's in GTP is guanosine, which is made up of guanine and ribose instead of adenine and ribose. Otherwise, it's just like ATP, just has a different nitrogenous base. And just like when ATP gets spent, that means dephosphorylating the ATP, right, to make ADP, an inorganic phosphate. That's what's happening here. GTP gets dephosphorylated to release some of its energy to form GDP, an inorganic phosphate that's not shown. Well, I hope that you are not surprised that building a polypeptide is an expensive process. That's going to require a lot of energy, right? You're building a polymer out of monomers. That's going to be an endergonic process. So this is just the beginning of the expenditure of energy, the part that happens in initiation. But when that GTP gets spent, that allows then for the large, or I should say a large ribosomal subunit, because it can be any of the copies. They're all modular. These two subunits might never see each other again, but you know, a large one comes in then and completes this whole complex, which is called the translation initiation complex. It's both of the ribosomal subunits plus the mRNA plus the aminoacyl tRNA that is carrying methionine and has an anticodon complementary to the start codon. All of that together is the initiation complex. Well, that brings us to 17 then, which is all about elongation, the next major phase of translation. It's named elongation for the same reason that transcriptional elongation is named. Something gets longer and longer, right? In transcription, you make the mRNA that's being built longer by one nucleotide at a time. Here you're not building a nucleic acid, you're building a polypeptide. So you make the polypeptide longer by one amino acid at a time in elongation. And this is why it's shown, this elongation process, as a cycle. It'll go through this cycle as many times as there are codons in that particular mRNA. Not all polypeptides are the same size, of course, right? It could be some, you know, 10 or 20 amino acids in a very simple polypeptide, or it could be thousands of amino acids in a more complex polypeptide. But the point is, elongation will continue as long as the codons that keep coming up into the A slot are any of the 61 that specify amino acids. In other words, as long as the codon that's being read is not any one of the three stop codons. It will just keep adding one amino acid at a time. And that process has already happened a few times in this. We're kind of looking at it. This isn't immediately after initiation. It's already gone through a few rounds, which is why this P slot one already has four amino acids connected to it. But notice you have an empty A slot. And this A slot is reading the current codon, which can be any one of those 61. Each individual codon, though, specifies exactly one type of amino acid. And that's why only the kind of tRNA with an anticodon complementary to that codon will be allowed in. That's what ensures the correct kind of amino acid to be added next. The reason it's allowed in is because it has perfect hydrogen bonding because of its complementarity between the anticodon of the tRNA and the codon of the mRNA. This is an aminoacyl tRNA coming in, though, right? Because this is just one of the pool of tRNAs that have already been charged with one amino acid under the enzymatic direction of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. That happens all the time, like I said, getting these aminoacyl tRNAs ready. Well, this tRNA's number came up, basically. Its codon came up, so it's time for it to come in, bringing its amino acid. Well, the next step involves more expenditure of energy. So another GTP gets spent, or dephosphorylated. And that will allow then for the peptide, however long it is, in this case four amino acids, to be transferred from the peptidyl tRNA in the P slot to the aminoacyl tRNA in the A slot. That's what this red arrow is indicating. And notice that means the names change now, because this peptidyl tRNA, once it loses the peptide, is no longer going to be a peptidyl tRNA. It's going to be an uncharged tRNA, even though it's still in the so-called P slot. And the aminoacyl tRNA that's in the A slot, by receiving that peptide and is now carrying 5, is now officially a peptidal tRNA, even though it's temporarily in the A slot still. Well, then spend another GTP, and that will allow for a shifting of the ribosome down the length of the mRNA one codon. It's like shifting a movie one frame. Here you're shifting it one codon. So these three will be the next codon that will be in the A slot once it shifts. And this uncharged tRNA that was carrying the 4 originally, but now is uncharged, will be in the E slot and get ejected. It goes back out, finds the correct kind of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase to charge it again with its particular kind of amino acid. So any given individual tRNA is going to go through all three possibilities. It's part of the time it's going to be an aminoacyl tRNA, part of the time it's going to be peptidal, and then part of the time it's going to be uncharged over and over. And now, because of the shifting, the new peptidal tRNA that's carrying all 5 of them will be in the P slot, which is what the P slot is named for, peptidal tRNA. All right, that will leave an empty A slot reading the new codon for another round. As long as that codon that comes up next in the A slot is anything other than a stop codon, then the same thing will continue. And the next amino acid will be brought in by the next aminoacyl tRNA. That's elongation. But notice that every additional amino acid that gets added requires expenditure of 2 more GTPs. You spent 1 for initiation, plus you have to spend 2 for every amino acid, however long it is. And so if it's thousands of amino acids long, which is not that's not unusual for a polypeptide, then that's an expensive thing to build. But you'd expect that. That's elongation. 18 shows you termination of translation. What really qualifies this as termination is that the codon that is being read at the empty A slot is any one of the 3 stop codons rather than one of the 61 amino acid specifying codons. UAG, UAA, UGA, those are all stop codons. It doesn't matter which one comes up. But unlike the start codon, the stop codons are doing single duty. They don't also specify amino acids, right? All they do is tell it to stop. Because of that fact, there is no kind of tRNA with an anticodon complementary to any of the stop codons, because the stop codons don't specify amino acids, right? Therefore, instead of a tRNA coming into the A slot when there's a stop codon being read, it's a protein instead of a tRNA. This yellow thing is a protein, special protein, called a release factor. That's another use of that word, factor, to indicate a protein of some sort. And when the release factor comes in, which it can because it recognizes the stop codon, then that is the signal to the ribosome telling it, in effect, the amino acid that you just added in the last round of elongation, that was the last one we needed. The polypeptide is done, in other words, as long as it needs to be. And therefore, it's time to disassemble this whole apparatus. So the polypeptide that's being carried up to this point by the peptidal tRNA gets detached from the tRNA. The tRNA becomes an uncharged tRNA. It's going to go get charged again by its own enzyme. And we have a free polypeptide. That simply means it's no longer connected to a tRNA. It's on its own. Then you spend 1 final GTP, or actually 2 final GTPs, but a final batch of GTPs, to disassemble the rest of this. The two ribosomal subunits detach from each other and detach from the release factor and the mRNA. They're all on their own. Now, a couple important things to say about this. One is that there's a disintegration of the apparatus, but not of the polypeptide, right? That would be completely counterproductive if you were to break it into amino acids. You would just undo what you just accomplished. So the polypeptide is still intact. That's the final product. That's the whole goal of this gene expression that we've been covering. But also, the mRNA is still intact. It's just not connected to the ribosome anymore. The red mRNA transcript is just as much a code as it was before this started. What I mean by that is that since it's still intact, exactly the same thing can happen again. The messenger RNA is reusable. It can hook up with another copy of a small ribosomal subunit to get initiation started. It can go through elongation and termination again, and that will result in another exact copy of the same polypeptide.
Has this one?
As that one. So don't think that transcription produces a messenger RNA, which then gets used just once in translation to produce one polypeptide. That same messenger RNA that gets produced gets reused many times to make many identical copies of the polypeptide.
Does the mRNA
Yes, because they're the same thing. It's just relativity, right? You can think of it either way. But in this picture, when the movement occurs, if you consider it to be the ribosome moving, it would be moving rightward in this picture. If you consider the mRNA to be moving, it would be moving leftward. But they really are two different ways to describe the same thing. This mRNA will continue to be translated as long as it exists. And the reason that's important is because the polypeptide that the messenger RNA codes for is needed in the cell. That's the whole reason why the gene expression happened, right? The gene was turned on to make this mRNA because you needed that particular kind of polypeptide. And you might need many copies of it. But eventually, you'll have enough. And it wouldn't be appropriate, once you have enough, to have this mRNA be translated even more to make even more copies of that now unneeded polypeptide. That would be wasteful of energy. Plus, the polypeptide is going to do whatever job it does, and you don't want that to be occurring anymore. Therefore, messenger RNA transcripts are not allowed to hang around indefinitely. After a while, the cell will digest the mRNA transcript into individual RNA nucleotides, which can then be used as raw materials to build any kind of RNA. They're just part of the RNA pool. That stops further translation so that you don't make more of those polypeptides. But all the information in that particular mRNA is lost when you disintegrate it, right? That's not a problem, though, even if you need the same polypeptide again a little bit later. Why is it not a problem? If you need that polypeptide again and you've already destroyed the mRNA, what do? It's like losing your instructions that you took home, right? You need to build it again. What do? Yeah, you go back to the library and make another copy of what you wrote down and lost, right? So if you need that polypeptide again, that mRNA is gone, but you just go back to the gene and transcribe it into a fresh copy that's identical to that mRNA, and then translate that into an identical copy of the polypeptide that you need. Genes get expressed on demand when that corresponding polypeptide is needed. All right, that's perfect timing because I was going to stop here no matter what.